Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Dave Weiner here, and another, this is number 13, Rebooting the News number 13. Jay, are you there?
I'm here.
My God, it works. Unbelievable. Hey, how's everything?
Everything is cool, everything is intense, and everything is ready for us to reboot the news.
So let's do it. Reboot the news for us, Jay. What's going on?
Well, we got four items on our agenda today. First, we have to discuss what's been going on in the world in Iran and the news system and Twitter over the last few days, which has been truly amazing. Then we have your endless cycle in the tech industry press that you want to talk about, and you're due for sources of inspiration. And then at the end, I want to talk about this concept of newsroom as cafe. So let's get right into it.
Sure. Start us off.
Well, over the last few days, we've just watched, I think, an extraordinary event unfold. When Tiananmen Square happened in 1989, I watched the whole thing on television. And what I knew from CNN and CBS.
Yeah.
And this time around, it feels very different. Feels like what television can tell me is minimal, and to find out what's going on in Iran, I have this whole other rebooted system.
Yes.
And in addition to that, there's plenty of professional journalists on that system, Twitter and the rest of the web, but they're pretty much doing what I'm doing, which is culling and editing and trying to figure out what's going on and working with a variety of sources. And the difference...
Who, by the way, are going direct.
Who are going direct, yes. Many sources going direct. And, of course, the problem of figuring out which ones to trust. But compared to 1989 and Tiananmen Square, we have a vastly different shifted
picture.
It's
amazing how quickly we've gone trying to, like, defend the idea that the news system had gone, it was already undergoing its rebooting process. If you recall, it was, we had already started doing this podcast, and it was, nobody really agreed with us that, that the system was already rebooting. And I don't think anybody would dispute it now that that we are living in the post-rebooted news system now. It's very different. From
lots
what
of
used
people
to be
are realizing how different it is, that's right.
Yeah.
How would you
when,
describe the differences?
Pardon me?
How would you describe the differences?
Well, it's, you know, I think, what would you compare it to? Okay, you said Tiananmen Square.
Mm-hmm.
There was also the Gulf War, which was also a CNN event, right?
Right.
There was the 11,000, which I was glued to. This is my own, glued to CNN and I guess mostly CNN. You know, while the Gore Bush thing shook out, and I was so overtoxified with news coverage that I had to, and I felt I had to, turn off my TV. So I actually called up the cable TV company and I said, "Come take the box. I don't want it anymore." And I had it turned off. And so when 9/11 happened in September of 2001, I didn't have TV, and so that whole thing for me was very much like this. I didn't get TV for another month after 9/11, and so everything that I learned about that either came from the internet, and if I first found out about the event, I got an email from a guy named Bill Seitz, who was a reader of my blog, and he said, "You got to look at this," and he sent me a link to a webcam that was on the Empire State Building, pointed south. And so I could see what was going on, even though I didn't have TV. I think I had every bit as good a picture as anybody watching TV. Plus, I had the emails of all the firsthand witnesses of it. So I was doing in 2001 more or less what you saw people doing here in 2009 with this event. I was completely on the web. And what I, the way I experienced that, and I expect to see that happen here, and it actually already is sort of happening, is that in the first hours of the event, we more or less owned the story in the blogosphere. And as the news, and because it happened in New York, you know, it was the news industry itself was a victim of the attack. But within 24 hours, they were on top of it and
right.
they were covering it. And I was getting my New York Times and happy to be doing that because they were doing a really bad. Now, that's happening now, too. The stories that we're linking to are coming from professional reporters who are there. I just read a story on Haaretz about this. So, you know, getting it from all points of view. So we are in a rebooted system. It is amateurs and pros, a level playing field. Everybody is, you know, glued to each other.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's a filter. Everybody is a distributor. And everybody's a participant who is online and networked in. Another thing to mention, Dave, is that Iran experienced a flowering of the blogosphere a while ago. And some of the seeds of that event, which goes back to 2002, 2003, 04, are obviously being felt now. And the other thing that's interesting to me about it is that in the beginning of the story, the professional reporters who are there and are risking their lives, risking arrest, you know, doing a lot of good work, really didn't have that much on the story because it was not an easy story to cover. They don't really have access to decision makers. They aren't necessarily able to get inside the regime. And for that reason, the immediate sources, people who are in Iran, people on Twitter, people who have a friend, people who just talk to their wife or cousin, kind of had as much purchase on the story as the professional journalists.
And they had the cell phones with the video cameras, too. So
they
the video
all the tools.
It was riveting. I mean, it was incredible material that we were getting. And all you had to do, I mean, this is where I was trying, I was watching CNN, I couldn't believe anything. So I went to YouTube and I started just searching on Tehran. And all these videos popped up. So I just started shooting them out to Twitter followers. I mean, I sent an email, Twitter at one point to Don Lemon at CNN. And I said, this is what you need to do, you know, go to YouTube and go get the videos. And never got a response. I mean, they could have had the same videos that I had at the same time I did.
I really think something went wrong over there at CNN.
What do you think that would be?
I'm not sure what it was, but they are not keeping pace with people's expectations, and they're not keeping pace with what they're able to do, and they don't seem all that committed to having the kind of central place in a big, moving, international, breaking story that they should have.
I just had a flash. This is like Dave. Isn't this like David Gregory covering the news? Isn't that what happened here? Aren't these guys just basically suits?
Well, I don't know, but they—if they're suits, they have a self-understanding in which they think of the main strength of CNN as coming alive during big breaking stories.
Right.
And as the international network that they have, because they are a global network for news, and they have this huge thing, CNN International, which covers the world, right? And so while the other networks have been shrinking and taking their correspondents away from all world capitals, CNN feels that this is their advantage. They're a global organization. They are great at breaking news. They're not the Fox News conservatives, and they're not the left-leaning MSNBC, right? They're hard news. And so with a big, moving, international story with huge resonance for people in democracies, that's all about freedom, and it's consequential as well, it just doesn't make any sense. And when we question them on Twitter, one thing we're able to do is at least get them to sort of answer our questions or face, you know, criticism. But they seem to be tone deaf because their reply was, well, we had more than MSNBC or we had more than Fox. We had the, you know, as opposed to measuring themselves against the shifting expectations that people have for news right now.
No, they were tone deaf. I watched it this afternoon for a few minutes, and you know, it was more like they still haven't connected with the story. They're not on top of it, and they think they are.
I think what they're
well,
missing.
No, I don't believe they really get. They really don't feel. It doesn't feel like they believe that they are. They're just saying that they are. They're saying it an awful lot.
Yes.
That we're following all the social media. That Sanchez was saying, you know, we're
right.
following all the social media. We're on top of. They even had one of their analysts sitting there with a BlackBerry, twittering away. You know.
Yeah. Oh well, that's the thing. They talk about Twitter all the time, but.
Right.
They don't seem to recognize that on Twitter they're kind of losing respect because
It was like what Brooke Gladstone said to you when you were on Moyers the other day, where she said, "Yes, but they have Twitter accounts."
Yeah. Well, they have.
Check it off. They've got
CNN,
the Twitter account.
Yeah.
But their soul isn't there. They don't have a soul in there, you know?
Soul? How about using your Twitter account? They have a CNN breaking news account with 1.8 million people subscribed to it. And over 2 days, they tweeted 5 times. Now, what is that? In what universe does that make sense for this news network? I don't get it at all, especially when they're promoting themselves on Twitter all the time. But I think we agree on that.
This segues into something that I said on Twitter a few days ago, which actually connects into the endless cycle thing.
Yes, let's transition.
Okay. What I said was, you know, they have a new CEO at Yahoo, Carol Bartz, and she's getting a lot of criticism. She's only been on the job for a short period of time, but the criticism she's getting is actually very similar to what we're talking about here. And so I sort of had a flash that, and I said it, that they ought to fire her, and they ought to hire a new CEO who is extremely conversant with Twitter, that is there on Twitter, you know, living, eating, sleeping, breathing Twitter, because what they should be doing is making every service that they have there relevant to Twitter. What got me going on this was that finally, you know, 2 years ago I had this thing called Twittergram, which connects up Flickr and Twitter. And so that's how I'm doing. You know, when I post a picture to Twitter, it goes to Twitter within a minute. And they finally have that feature with Flickr, and everybody in Flickr land is really excited about that, as they should be, because it's a very, very, very important feature. All of a sudden, Flickr now becomes real-time. It's not really anything new because, you know, there are all these products that have developed up, you know, TwitPic and YTurtle or whatever. There's so many different ways of doing that that they're no longer, like, breaking new ground. But it's still – so it leads you to this conclusion that almost everything now needs to hook into Twitter. It just does. It's just
because
Why? You're asking a leading question. Why don't you answer it?
Well, I want to know what you think.
Oh, okay. So it's not a leading question. Well, why? Because it just does, Jay. I mean, that's just the way the world is right now. Twitter is the backbone. It's the messaging system. It's the internet. It is. I mean, I was saying this in an interview I did earlier today on this podcast, is that we've stuffed the entire internet into 140 characters, and it does not fit, okay? But we're making it fit by hook or by crook.
Here's the way I would say it.
Go ahead.
We need everyone in the news system,
mm-hmm.
and Twitter is the way we can get everyone into the news system.
We've decided that that is the way to do it.
Yeah.
That's correct.
But
yeah.
it's the closest thing we have.
Well, we so badly need a consensus that we'll accept this limit.
Right.
This crazy, unbelievable.
With all its limitations, right.
140. How much time did you spend? I just read a thing where you said you spent 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Trimming down this one thing.
Composing one tweet, yeah.
The perfect 140-character tweet.
Yes.
And it worked, right?
It worked, yeah. It totally worked. It was worth it.
But it is a statement of the times we live in. You know, you'll have your grandchildren on your knee. So,
yeah.
You know, and you'll tell them, you know, there was a day when you had
right.
to go out.
And it'll be funny that we put up with this. But it was funny
yeah.
when you put up with any of the stages in computing, right, to get the power.
The war stories are legendary. Kids,
yeah.
they don't believe you when you said I had disks that only stored 140K, but I just thought they were the best thing ever, you know? They were great.
Okay, back to endless cycles.
Endless cycles. So the computer industry is always cycling. It's always at some point in this cycle where well, I can tell you, I don't want to make this too long because it could easily become a very long story because it's the story of my life in the computer industry. You know, when I first came into it at the age of roughly 22, I had an education, but I wasn't in the industry. So it was after getting my master's degree, I'm starting to come out and looking around to see what's there, and I'm reading the magazines and going, man, this stuff doesn't make any sense. This seems really complicated. When I finally would figure out what they're talking about, I'd go, this should be a lot easier, you know? And so I just sort of asked myself, do I have to understand this? Because I had a fork in the road. You know, a lot of my classmates went into jobs where they had to where their thing was they understood all of that stuff, and that was what they sold. That was the expertise they sold. Mm. I went the other direction. I said, nah, I'm not going to learn this stuff. We're just going to reinvent it, okay? And so we did, and that was the microcomputer industry and PCs. Apple II became the IBM PC. Along the way, it was CPM, you know. And we did. We reinvented it, and the pros of the day looked at what we did, and they said, this is ridiculous. We've had all this stuff working for 5 years, right? Because they did it to the mainframe guys, right? So we did it to them, and then along come graphic computers, and it happened again, right? And every time you go through one of these cycles, after that came the web, and the web basically threw out everything we had done in graphic personal computing and started all over again, right? And now here we go, right? Because what we're doing is we're throwing out Flickr and we're throwing out YouTube and we're throwing out, because they're reinventing everything. Even Hot or Not now is going to be inside of Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's getting reinvented inside Twitter. Well, have we seen this before? Absolutely. It's another reinvention, another cycle. And every time you get a cycle, Jay, what happens is not only does the industry reinvent itself, but the press does too.
Ah.
Whole new crop of the tech press reinvents itself.
Right.
And that is a very important point. The reason why that happens is because the press of the old generation eventually gets into bed with the vendors of the old generation, and then the users get tuned into this. They figure out what's going on, and they don't trust them. And so usually what happens is the users become the next generation of the press. And that has been happening more and more, and as the cycles have been tightening, because the barriers to entry in the press side keep going down. So if you look at this, yeah, you see what's going on, right? So, and I think we're finally maybe at the point where we don't even get a cycle in the press, okay? Because look what happened. In 4 years ago, TechCrunch starts up, right? And it really literally was their fourth birthday this week. And I was there at the start. Mike Harrington and I were friends. In fact, you ask him, he'll tell you. I was the one that told him he needed to start a blog, okay? And I told him, I gave him the formula, and it was the formula that he used. And TechCrunch in the early days was something to behold. I mean, he was on fire. This guy really, and what was he? He was a user that was just in love with the technology, and everybody looked to him because he had no axe to grind, no conflicts of interest, just straight, this is what I love, right?
And he could have been wrong. With the insiders and the sources and the industry.
Because there were no insiders, right? Mm-hmm. It hadn't grown to that point yet where there were. These were all startups. These were all individuals. These are people who hadn't even been funded. Now, Mike wouldn't like what I'm about to say, but I believe it's 100% true. Mike no longer is doing any of that stuff. He represents the VCs. And so when he writes about something, what you're really reading is what the VCs want you to hear, and the venture capitalists, the financiers of the tech industry. And so that's the purest form of vendor, they call it, vendor sports. It's the purest form because you're not even dealing with the vendor at the companies. You sort of have some people in there who kind of care about the users and care about the products and stuff like that. The VCs care about their, you know, they've got a job to do, and they buy the press. And now what's going to happen is the barriers to entry are down so incredibly low that we don't even need press anymore.
So how do we break the endless cycle?
Pardon me?
How do we break the endless cycle?
Well, it's not up to us to do that, to break it or not break it. It either breaks or it doesn't. One way to do it is to – oh, okay, there are ways. There is an answer to that question. I asked this the other day that that it's – if you're a vendor, no more interviews. You don't give interviews anymore. Everything that you communicate gets communicated publicly from your communication. And because, see, if you ask Charles Arthur at the Guardian, and believe me, he volunteered this. I didn't have to ask him. Let me be careful about this.
Yeah.
Let me back off this. Okay. Let me back off this. Let me just make a general statement, okay? If you want Steve Jobs on the cover of your publication, you better not say anything bad about Steve Jobs.
Well, sure.
It's accepted as a given in the industry, okay? So one way to clean it up is to say, we're never going to put Steve Jobs on the cover.
Right.
You know, we're going to be very upfront with you. These are the rules. You can trust us because the day you see Steve Jobs on our cover, stop buying our publication because we've sold out. And, you know, so and take that where it goes. If you're on the vendor side, don't give interviews. Just write on your blog. Tell the people that want to interview you, you can read about what I have to say, but I'm not going to give you an exclusive, and I'm not going to put you under embargo, and I'm not going to give you any advantage over the users. The users are going to find out about the stuff the same day you do. So now you have to compete on that playing field. And if you can do that, then more power to you. You know?
Hmm. You know,
it really
reminds
has
me of something.
To be that simple.
That's interesting. It reminds me of something that has been stuck in my mind for 2 weeks. Benjamin Netanyahu came to Washington a few weeks ago and met with Obama and tried to do what all Israeli prime ministers do, which is to figure out what is the real agenda of the White House beneath what they say for public consumption. And what he discovered, to his dismay, was that the policy of the Obama White House was the same as the stated policy of the Obama White House.
Interesting.
And that the more he looked for what the real message was, the more he got back the official message or the public message, which, because they were the same things, right?
How do you know that?
Huh?
How do you know that? Happened.
It was reported by Laura Rosen, R-O-Z-E-N, in The Cable, which is a new blog on the Council on Foreign Relations. She's an experienced national security reporter who I've read for a long time. She used to had a blog that was really good. Just that whole idea that you eliminate the inside story by making the inside policy the same as the outside policy.
Right.
And that changes the dynamic with the press.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the only way to go.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, it's like you don't, I don't do the interviews. Like, there was this great story that appeared in the Times about the suggested user list. And I was very, very pleased with what they did. I mean, I think they did a better job than I could have done because nobody would have believed me if I had said the things that they said. You know, they would have said, oh, there's your axe to grind. Well, when it comes from the Times, they don't say that. However, I would not do the interview with him. He asked me to help him, and I did. All I did was send him links to stories that I had written publicly. But my policy on that stuff is I don't do interviews. However, if you ask me a question, I may write a blog post about it.
Right.
But it's going to be public, and everybody else is going to read it too. And, you know, and that way there can never be any question about what I said. You can't, you know, sometimes you get these run-ins with the reporters where they say, where they interpret what you've said. But if you haven't done an interview with them, you can ask them. They have to show you your words. They have to say, these are the words that I was citing, and they can't play that game anymore. Now they have to have that kind of discipline that I want them to have.
It makes me wonder whether professional journalists really want transparency. because the more that there is transparency, the less the kind of insider savvy form of journalism, we're connected to the movers and shakers, you're not. We know the real story. You only have what they put out for public consumption, right? You get the spin. We get the facts. That whole psychology, that whole structure can tumble once you have Netanyahu's discovery, you know? It just stuck with me, that line, that the story is the story.
You know, Hillary Clinton, I heard an interview with her on one of the Sunday talk shows, and she was saying that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Is that we want to make sure that the story, the things that people are saying privately, match up with the things that they're saying publicly.
Right.
And I had this whole image as she was telling the story of the guy, I can't think of their names, but the guy from Egypt and the guy from Jordan and all of our allies in the Middle East. Yeah, that they're all talking out of both sides of their mouth. That they won't say to their people the things they say to the United States because whatever, they've got this game going on that requires them to do that. You know, that they've compromised themselves so many different ways. But that is the
whole origin of the savvy press, is that the inside story is different from what the public facade is, and we're gonna find that we're going to scratch away the public facade and get at, you know, the inside story. And that's
so
when they have you.
Well, not if we don't pay any attention to it. That's number one. If we don't pay any attention to it, it doesn't have any power. The other thing is, that just expired this week with the Iran story. All their inside stuff didn't get them this story. We the people had this story long before they did. So if their inside sources are so great, why did they not get this story before we did?
Because there is no sources inside the Iranian power structure, and so what is important is what's happening outside of it. You have our sources of inspiration for this week, don't you?
I do. But actually, before I do that, I just want to say what you just mentioned, which is that I watched the press with Ahmadinejad, and I was really proud of the Western reporters there.
I didn't see it. What did they do?
They pushed him. And,
good.
And, you know, they asked, there was a reporter from The Economist who pushed, and you could, you know, and the guy blew smoke up his, you know what. And Christiane Amanpour played the perfect straight man to him and got him to say basically that must have heard the story about the parking thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's where that came from. Mm-hmm. And it was at 4 a.m. Pacific time on Saturday night. So that's why hardly anybody saw it. I just happened to be up and happened to flip on the TV and saw it.
Now, one more thought on this Iranian story. And this, I remember, was something that really struck me in Tiananmen Square, too, so many years ago, 20 years ago. That in an interconnected world, if an open space, a free society exists one place in the globe, it can have a huge effect on another place in the globe which doesn't have that openness.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you can export freedom by the tools of communication that move freely across the borders. And so that's why one reason it's very important to have strong democracies anywhere we can get them is that in certain times like this, they can almost come to the aid of the weak democracies because the tools are there to connect those polities over distance.
So many things to say on that. I read a book called All the Shah's Men by Stephen Kinzer. So for the United States to, and I think that Obama is doing exactly the right thing. There's been some discussion about whether or not, one other thing I wanted to mention is that FriendFeed has a big Iranian following. There's a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
So that's worth watching for, too. For the United States to be a stalwart here, to just stand up for them but not get involved in this, that is the perfect stance for us to take, and it is perfect balancing because the last 30 years have been just creating equilibrium for the mess that we created there. And when they had democracy, they wanted democracy, and they had it. And we canceled that. So the last 30 years was a equilibrium. Now it's time for them to have democracy. And I had this feeling looking at the crowds there that these were ripples in the same wave that that we experienced in the United States last year. It looked so much like, although we didn't have to go into the streets to do it, we probably would have gone into the streets this time, I think. You know? So I think we all feel a tremendous kinship with the people of Iran right now, and proud of them for standing up for themselves the way they are.
They are a source of inspiration.
They are, and I didn't want to pass that without pointing that out. However, in a more prosaic way, my source of inspiration this week is Amazon. And which
Amazon.com.
That's correct. And which is very ironic, given that I was a anti-advocate for Amazon for quite a number of years because of what they were doing with software patents. And so if you go back to the archive, this is a flip-flop. I've become a big fan of as their strategy with web services has emerged. I really, really believe in what they're doing, and I think that they're really, really smart people, and I like what they're doing. So
what's the trajectory there? What has been their trajectory?
What has been? Well, let me say why I want them to name them this week as the inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, you asked, we were talking about the endless cycles or the endless cycle of the technology industry. If it breaks this time, it will be Amazon that will have made a huge contribution to that breakage, because if you shop on, it's a general thing. It just becomes, I can't shop any other way than the way it works on Amazon, and I've tried. I've had to buy some large ticket items. Stereo equipment was the first time I realized this. I went to Fry's, which is Mecca for gadget gear and stuff here in California. And when I was looking at a product, I was lost because I couldn't read the Amazon reviews for the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost would prefer to have bought the product without even listening to the stereo, just by seeing what other people said about it. And in a way, it's made the tech press irrelevant, because I now go straight to the source. And the source are other users, and they write with a passion for the product.
Right.
And for themselves and for each other. And it's an amazing thing. It has completely revolutionized the way product information flows. And I think that it has much greater import, because when it's like what you said with democracy, and once democracy happens in one place, it's harder for it to not take place elsewhere. Technology press is the sort of birthing ground for the next generation of press everywhere. It really is going to turn out that way, that when it happens in the technology industry, that's one generation before it happens everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so blogging happened in the technology industry 10 years ago, you know, maybe 12 years ago it started. And a lot of the principles that started there now are starting to become as prevalent in the broader world, not the real world, the broader world. And so when you see e-commerce becoming Amazonized, it's only a matter of time before the electoral process and the governing process becomes that way too.
Some responses and some questions for you about that, about Amazon.
Pardon me?
I said I have some responses and some questions for you about
Amazon. Okay, sure. Yeah.
First of all, in the response category, I think part of the reason for this, for the inspirational force that Amazon has, is that they were a company that really took the user's knowledge seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And tried very hard to make it both easy to add your knowledge and easy for it to add up, which
mm-hmm.
is key. Secondly, they really wanted participation in addition to consumption, in addition to sales. And they saw the two as strategically linked. Very important insight that they had. Mm-hmm. My questions are, what about some of the more recent forays of developments of Anison, like the server capacity and things like some of the other businesses they started, like Mechanical Turk and mm-hmm. things like that? What I thought you were going to talk about those things as possible sources of inspiration, because Amazon has developed way beyond just an online retailer. It's becoming more of a web company in general.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I have read the tea leaves in these tech companies. That's how I do it. You know, I'm always looking for. I think that's the real business, Jay. I think that. I think that all of the stuff they do with e-commerce mm-hmm. is just a proving ground for what their real business is, which is this stuff that you're talking about right there. Is that it's the infrastructure that interests them, not the actual sales of the products that they're selling, not
right.
even the user.
It's like the products provide the cash they can use to build more infrastructure.
It is beautiful, because that is exactly how you do software development, is by creating the problem that you want to solve and living it, and then having that bootstrap up the solution. You can't miss the mark this way. If you create an e-commerce system that works in the human world, you can't possibly miss the mark. However,
right.
a lot of companies would have done it very differently and would have missed it. And by the way, Amazon typically doesn't play the industry game that the other tech companies do.
Mm-hmm.
When they are invited to alliance meetings and standards bodies and all the rest of it, they don't go.
Okay.
They're just not interested. And
so
I think that's
How would a news company behave if it took Amazon as a source of inspiration? I mean, how is Amazon a source of inspiration for a rebooted system of news?
Oh, now there's a perfect segue into the next part, because it would do very much like what you're going to talk about with the cafe. It would build infrastructure. It would first create news coverage in that context, and then it would export that or replicate it everywhere.
Uh-huh.
In other words, let's take a lab somewhere. Let's revolutionize news in, say, a place like Berkeley, California, and let's understand how that works, you know, and then let's do it in 50,000 other places.
Newsroom as cafe.
Go for it.
It's been an idea that's floated around.
We have about five, seven
minutes, which is perfect for this. It's been an idea that's been floating around. A number of people have had it, but as we've developed these podcasts and as we've zeroed in on our subject, I've come to value more and more any sort of image that gets us out of the old system of news and provides just a strikingly new way of thinking about it, right? So one of our listeners, Daniel Bachhuber, who's a young man, very interested in news, wants to rethink it, wants to reboot it, listens to these podcasts, came out with a post this week called Newsroom as Cafe, in which he simply tries to imagine a news organization springing from a very active cafe. And he pictures the cafe as being like a meeting ground, a place where local feeds, for example, from FriendFeed or Twitter or Flickr are playing on the walls, where people can come to learn new skills for the news ecosystem, where they can find equipment if they need to record something or capture something for others to know about. And it started me thinking that if I were advising someone today who wanted to invest in a local news operation, I would tell them it's probably smarter to invest the money in a cafe and then build a news organization around that by making the cafe a central meeting point, by making it a place you go when you have news and when you want to provide a news tip, but also simply by developing it in sort of 18th century coffeehouse fashion as a place where people who have news or have something to say meet each other, and then adding to that the modern tools of the web and of technology, so that it's a wired space, it's also a space on the web, it's a physical space in the community, it's a gathering place, and it's the place where the whatever staff you can afford for that news organization works and sits and presides in the cafe itself. So the cafe is a newsroom in addition to being a cafe. And right now, it's much more likely that you would develop a revenue stream from a cafe than it is from just printing news.
In other words, you sell coffee, right?
Yes, you sell coffee. And you sell conviviality, and you sell connection to the local news. Right. And another thing you could do, for example, would be have a meeting space where people can hold their meetings, with the only charge being that reporters from the news organization can sit in. You know, you could add on to it other public functions. You could make your editorial meetings, weekly editorial meetings, where people could come and pitch stories, so that the news that emerged from the cafe was responsive to the community. I just think it's just a useful image for us to reimagine a system of news and the connections between online and offline life. And it just gets us out of the factory era of news production.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've given this pitch a number of times. I call that hypercamp, and it's exactly what you said. I don't need to add anything to it. It's 100%. That is the way it's going to work, because you know the virtual presence isn't enough.
No, it isn't.
Need to have the face-to-face connection. Human beings thrive on that, and the times that we have had that happen serendipitously, is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
In the tech blogosphere have been wonderful. I mean, there have been a number of times when it's just happened by accident, where we happen to be in a room, we have a lot of time, the right people are there, both bloggers and sources, there's a lot of food, great connectivity, and you know, it happened once at the O'Reilly Open Source Convention in Monterey, California in 1999. I was there for that. Don't have the time to explain what happened, but it was fantastic. It happened at a Microsoft press briefing in the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, which led me to say that you have your press events there. It's the it's the newsroom, open newsroom.
Yes, open newsroom. Yeah,
right.
And
the open news sources are part of it. They have to be part of it. It's the news is part of it. It's the pulse. It is how CNN works. And you put one in San Francisco, one in Washington D.C., one in New York.
Once you establish them, then you imagine them linked, and you're really cooking, right?
Well, the link comes for free. It's called the internet.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, we already are linked. Linked part we've got,
and
you have video there. I envision this situation where you're sitting here at your booth and you're watching video of something that's happening 5 feet away. You know, but of course, if you want to go ask a question, you get up and go over there.
Right, exactly. And lo and behold, this week I read on the net that some techies in Cambridge want to start a coffee house in Cambridge, so that the local tech community has a place to meet. And now just imagine the local tech news blog as an adjunct or as an outgrowth of that cafe, and you have Newsroom as cafe.
Yeah, I want to see this happen so badly.
Lots of people do.
I know.
It's actually caught the imagination of a lot of people over the years.
I know, and I'm so delighted that this is happening. So? I think this is instrumental. It's key for rebooting the news. It's absolutely the way it's going to happen, so. We now have 22 seconds, and I don't know how we're going to fill the space.
Well,
would you like to sing a song?
No, but I want to urge all the people in all the corners of the world who are listening to our podcast to just simply help us reboot the news. It's there for the taking.
Rebootnews.com.
Good, Dave.
That's it. We're done. Beautiful.
Bye.
We're not recording anymore. We're over.
Oh, fantastic.
Now we just hope that there's an MP3 out the other end. I told you I was going to do a redundant recording. I didn't. Sorry. I realized 5 minutes into it that I had spaced that out. But I think this was great. I think this is absolutely fantastic.
Well, let's hope they got it.
They got it.
Let me know, will you?
I will absolutely let you know.
All right.
All right. Good night, Jay.
Good night.
Bye.